Rolling down the Imperial Highway with a big nasty redhead at my side, it's time for the SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C. Episode 25 is here and in your ears. That means in 2 weeks, episode 26 will drop. What's so special about that? Well, if you realize that we release every other week, then 26 is half of 52, meaning that our next episode is our one-year anniversary show. That drops on March 25th. Which is exactly the date in 2014 that episode 1 of this program dropped and went live for you. So the SAFTAcast will be 1 year old, and I don't like to think of it as anniversaries, I like to think of it as birthdays on the SAFTAcast. So we're going to have our birthday show in 2 weeks. Who's the guest? I'll tell you that on Wednesday next week with the promo on the 18th, but I'll give you a little hint. A couple hints, how about that? First, it is someone that some of our listeners have actually asked me in the past and said, Scott C., are you ever going to have so-and-so on? And here it comes. Two, they have a birthday today. So, happy birthday, future guest. And, well, let me put it this way, folks. You may know my voice, but I am not the only strand of DNA in this program. No. Our guest in 2 weeks for the birthday show will be someone who is another one of those DNA strands that makes up this program behind the scenes. Ooh, should be a good one, folks. That's in 2 weeks, though. After that, we're going to kind of shift gears a little bit. We've got an episode coming up in the second week of April to help a lot of you with your travel plans that week. Some of you may be traveling around the country to Minneapolis that week. So we're going to have an episode for you as you commute. Now, why would a bunch of people, writers, editors, and publishers be convening on Minneapolis in April? The answer is AWP. For those unaware and those who are not in the know, it is the massive convention of writers, editors, and publishers from throughout North America and beyond. They gather together once a year. This year it is in Minneapolis, and the SAFTAcast will be in attendance. We will be there as part of the Sundress Publications table and booth in the book fair, as well as the SunTrust Academy for the Arts. It's all under one title there. I'll be there. You'll get the chance to meet me if you happen to go to it. And I know what you're thinking immediately. Even if you're not there, even if you're not going, you're thinking right now, Scott C., are you bringing your stuff with you? Are you going to record a SAFTAcast or two at AWP? And the answer is yes. We are in the works right now to get at least one full-length normal show for you while we're there. But we're also planning a second very special type of show. We're doing something, and I've been hinting at this for a couple of months now, and I want to finally explain it to you. We are going to be doing a special edition of the SAFTAcast in May, titled The Randa Cast. What we are planning to do is we are going to set up shop near or right on next to or on top of the Sundress booth in the book fair, and we are going to take any and all comers. Meaning, if you want to be on this program and you're going to be at AWP, all you have to do is come over to Sundress when we're there, set up shop. We'll have the dates and times for you at the table. You just stop on by and we'll give you a 5-minute interview, and then we'll piece them all together into one giant episode for you in May. I don't know. This is an experiment. We have no idea if this is going to work or not. It's just crazy enough that it might work. Just any and all comers. I don't care who they are. I just want them on. I want to see how many we can pack into one episode here. I think it would be amazing. I think it would be as amazing as our guest today on episode 25. Neil Atkin is on the program today. Neil is a Neil of many trades, as you will soon see. He is very knowledgeable about a plethora of things. Programmer, he's a poet, he's an editor, he's a storyteller, he's a doctoral candidate, he is a global traveler. He is interested in so many different things, and we have a wonderful discussion, I think, for you today, dealing with the philosophy of detectives, the philosophies of logic in detectives. Why is it that we always want the detective to solve the crime, for example? We also talk about a bunch of other things like the connections between science and poetry. We talk about our love of teaching, why we enjoy stories that don't go traditional ways. They kind of screw with our heads a little bit, and much, much more. You're going to like this, but you're only going to like it in about 31 seconds, because that's how long the theme song is.
Hey, Scott.
Nice to have you on the program.
Well, it's good to be here.
Good to have you. I know our schedules. You're a very busy man.
Yeah, it feels like that right now. Yeah.
Well, you just got through your dissertation, I believe.
No, still cranking through it. Yeah, I have a little bit left to finish in my last chapter, and then I have to go back and fix things in my previous two chapters. So.
I know how that is. I went through the process myself.
I think I've gone through this chapter about three or four times. No, probably eight times. I think. Different approaches to try to make it work. In the end, I've just decided to cut most of the stuff I thought was cool, but just won't fit in, and stick with what needs to be done. So,
do I dare ask what it's about?
It's about, well, the current title of the dissertation is 19th Century Artificial Intelligences, Thinking Machines, Mechanized Minds, and the Victorian Detective. And basically, it looks at Sherlock Holmes as a new type of subjectivity, a new type of intelligence, really, and how he emerges out of 19th century speculation around whether or not a machine could be a thinking other.
In a way, is he like the first crime computer?
He's the first really pure crime computer. Yeah, when you look at like Poe writes about Inspector Dupin. And a lot of people point to Murders on the Rue Morgue or a couple other stories that he wrote about Inspector Dupin as being some of the earlier detective stories. But even that, it's interesting when you read through, you see Inspector Dupin actually has two personalities. And the narrator will comment on how his voice changes when he switches between sort of his general, more cordial, you know, personality to the tone he adopts when he's actually solving crimes. In both cases, he's rather removed and distant, but he's still more cordial in one mode when interacting with human beings, and then in another mode when interacting with data and thinking about, you know, the logic of a crime.
So what happens with Holmes then? What does he do different?
Holmes, I'll give away one of the great little things I found in the course of my research. Arthur Conan Doyle writes in a letter about a year or two after he had created Sherlock Holmes. He writes in a letter to his mentor, who he actually partly bases Sherlock Holmes on. He writes in a letter, he says, Sherlock Holmes is as unfeeling as one of Babbage's calculating machines and just as unlikely to fall in love. And right there in the letter, really explicitly makes a connection between Sherlock Holmes and his personality, his lack of empathy, his logic and reasoning with Charles Babbage's calculating engines, the difference engine and the analytical engine, both of which were basically the early prototypes of the modern computer.
Makes sense now why Data on Star Trek was so obsessed with Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, it totally does. If I had enough time, I would write another chapter on sort of 20th century sci-fi and how most of those android characters or artificial intelligences really have their roots in the type of character that's constructed in Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, because as you were talking about it, I started thinking of Minority Report.
Yeah.
And the crime-solving forecasting computers that are humans, but anyway. What got you interested in this topic?
So, long story short, my undergraduate degree is in computer science and mathematics, and I worked for a number of years as a computer games programmer. So I grew up kind of in a weird intersection between technology and literature. My parents both worked in libraries. My father was a professional librarian. So I was surrounded by books, and I loved language and literature. But at the same time, my father was good to bring home like a computer early on. So we had a PC Junior at home. And I taught myself how to program. And so I was coding and writing poetry about the same time. And so I was always interested in sort of like looking at how the two worlds intersected. And I've always been fascinated with the 19th century and especially Charles Babbage, who is this kind of an all-round genius in a lot of different areas. He's a mathematician, he's an economist. He's an inventor, an engineer. He's the developer of new systems he invented occulting lights, which is the signaling system used in lighthouses and on ships. And he invented the universal postage rate. It was one of the things that he suggested and it was later adopted. He had a part in the construction of copyright, and he had a lot of other roles that he played. in society. So I've always been fascinated with sort of this kind of a figure who has his hand in almost everything. And yet, you know, when you read his writing, you'll see him switch between being very technical and being very eloquent. In the 19th century, there really wasn't a barrier between being a person of letters and being a person of science. You could do both.
That explains it, because I've gotten into discussions before with the crossover between science and poetry. Mm-hmm. And so many people, like, when I teach students and such, like, they seem like they're completely parallel universes, but I'm like, no, there's this huge crossover between astrophysics and biology looking at poetry and vice versa. They're deeply in bed with each other.
Yeah, I mean, really what we're looking at, I tell people, when people hear that I used to be a programmer, and they say, well, how can you do poetry? Aren't those two completely different parts of your brain? I say, well, the reality is they're not. We use different language to describe what we're doing, but basically it's the same thing. You know, to be a programmer is to work with language, rules and grammar. You write under, you know, constraint. You write with an eye towards efficiency and flexibility. You have to bring a certain amount of innovation to thinking of new solutions given a limited set of tools that you have available. And you want something to happen at the end. You want to make something new occur. And really, that's poetry, right? I mean, that's what we do, is we work within rules, we bend rules, we have to know a language inside and out, and we're always looking to make something happen that didn't exist before. And it's kind of a magic, too, is that we take language, we take words, text, and we make them into something that is an experience, an emotional or rational, or psychological experience, maybe even a social experience, out of pure, you know, words on a page or words on a screen, somehow turn into something bigger than just simply, you know, the recipe that we've concocted.
So is erasure poetry then Frankencode?
No, I think it's a different type of, I mean, it's more of a, I think it has more in line with archaeology, you know, and sculpting. You know, it's the excavation of text and looking at, you know, and modern art to some respect, you know, instead of being fixated on surface, there's sort of what lies beneath the surface. Is there a different look at language as this material? And then we kind of shape within that. What can we pull out? A different narrative, a different, or maybe it's a palimpsest, you know, it's sort of text written on top of text on top of text. And sort of if you play a game in erasure where you say that there is another story or another narrative here, that I just need to, you know, reveal by taking away things until it shows up.
Hadn't considered that. I'm trying to think, not collage poetry. There's a form of poetry, I forget what it is, where you take a line from other poems and you just stick them all together into one.
Cento.
Yes, the cento.
I have a couple friends that love doing centos. I've tried. They're hard, actually.
They are. I think I've only tried one, and that was using my spam email headlines that I had gotten, just uh-huh. The subject lines, and trying to put that all together to see if there was some kind of narrative there, but I abandoned that one a long time ago.
Yeah, to me, like, a lot of that becomes, I don't know, I've had poems where I start off with a particular approach. Like, maybe I say I'm going to write a sestina, or I'm going to write a villanelle of some sort, or a chazal, you know, it's another one. And at some point I realize I have failed. I have grievously, terribly failed in my attempt to create this thing. But somewhere in the process, somewhere buried in what I've, in my failure, are the seeds of a different poem that isn't constrained by the, you know, what I set up to do. And if I can liberate it from that, maybe I have a poem that's worth writing after all.
That's greatly satisfying too.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just me placating myself and just saying, hey, you know, it's like, it's not all bad. There's something else I can do with this.
But it's better than crawling up in a whiskey bottle or something and going, I can't get this right.
No, that's how I feel about the dissertation. You know, I feel like I should just curl up somewhere and pretend it will blow up. And I think the way that I'm finishing this chapter is basically, you know, in a sense, it's like I'm writing an erasure of what the chapter I wanted to write. I am now writing the erasure of it, where I'm just excavating and removing stuff until I can find a narrative that is coherent and simple enough that someone reading it is going to follow it all the way through. Instead of, I think my obsession with the material has basically gotten to the point where I have too much information and I see too many connections, and then it becomes impossible for me to navigate it, and indefinitely it becomes impossible for a reader to follow what I've tried to do.
My pop culture brain immediately thought of the Encyclopedia Britannica kid in the follow-up commercial where they're like, I got a B on that report. Too much information. It's an obscure reference for our listeners. Go look it up.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get beyond Sherlock Holmes for a second.
Okay.
Are there other detectives that you're fascinated with?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. I guess I find like Sherlock Holmes gets reinvented on a regular basis. So, I mean, I'm not really getting beyond it. But, you know, you look at House. House is a Sherlock Holmes, right? And definitely we have got these modern interpretations, you know, of sort of the elementary series or the new Sherlock. But beyond that sort of, you know, version of the detective, I think we get into, I don't know. I feel like, you know, I grew up reading, my parents were both huge mystery buffs. So I grew up reading everything that they brought home. So I read like, a lot of Ellis Peters and the Brother Cadfael series, you know. So you have a medieval monk who solves, I think he's 11th century, solves murders using extremely rudimentary forensic science that he's basically is, you know, he's a herbalist and he's also the person that prepares bodies for burial. And so he uses his, you know, very beginning stages of forensic science to solve things. And, you know, even Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose has elements of a mystery novel in there. I'm, you know, hesitate to say who exactly is the detective, but there's a 19th century novel, a very famous one called The Moonstone, who has sort of an early version of the detective figure in there. But he fails. He is unable to figure out the mystery. And you end up with multiple characters, you know, narrating multiple approaches to trying to solve this mystery. And then when the thing finally unravels, you know, it's very different from what you expect.
It's funny you mention that because I can't think of another famous fictional detective who regularly fails. They always succeed.
You know, we love that. We love the idea that reason triumphs. And I think part of the, you know, the detective figure is that the figure is a, you know, an embodiment of, you know, one of the things that I get into in my dissertation, I'm going to talk dissertation stuff, I guess, a lot, but
no, that's okay. We'll change the conversation soon enough, but
there are plenty of other things to talk about, but you know, I write a lot about the automaton in my dissertation because that's one of the ways that Holmes refers to himself and others refer to him as being an automaton. And so, you know, this automaton, this clockwork or mechanized man, basically. The interesting thing about the automaton is that in the Middle Ages, the word referred to any sort of clockwork representation of a system or a world. And so you would have not always clockwork representations of individuals, but you would have entire scenes like a coronation scene or a nativity scene or the conquest of a new land scene, you know, these type of things. And you'd have all these clockwork figures moving. Sometimes there were planetary, you know, it would be, you know, little solar systems. But in all these cases, you know, I was reading this really interesting, actually it was, I attended an interesting talk about this, and the researcher brought up this really fascinating approach to thinking about it. And she said that really, during this time period, an automaton was a model of an understanding of the world. And I thought, that's a really it's an embodiment of a way of perceiving the world. And it reinforces what people believe about the world. And so Sherlock Holmes and these other figures of pure reason, pure rationality, kind of represent then a model of how we think of the world or how one person thinks of the world. And if it is purely rational, if everything can be explained, I think, you know, part of the appeal of that is that it answers questions for us. It makes us feel comforted to believe that everything has a logical explanation, that everything fits into place. Even things that seem, you know, chaotic or irrational or unbelievable in their cruelty can have some sort of logical explanation. But I think as we move further into the 20th century and into the 21st century, it starts to become more complicated. Psychology takes a deeper role in this. And then the logics that are being revealed are not necessarily logics of reason, but logics of some other type of pathology or some other type of, you know, it's a logic that doesn't, you know, maybe it resides, you know, what it takes as its axioms are not the things that we think of in terms of science.
We want to make order out of all chaos. We want to have some kind of meaning behind it, but then we get into postmodernism of there is no meaning. There never was any meaning. You want a piece of art? Here's a picture of a duck. Congratulations.
Yeah. Okay. So classic example of this, and this is also from Umberto Eco, is his fantastic book, Foucault's Pendulum. I don't know if you've ever read it, but...
I've read selections of it like in undergrad theory class.
It's huge, right?
It's huge. And
the thing with Foucault's Pendulum, you know, underlying this whole story is basically this idea, is that you have, you know, so the setup is basically this. These guys run two presses. They run a very prestigious and respected press. And then on the side, you know, seemingly completely separate, they have a second press, which is a vanity press, where they basically publish crackpot theories. Because there are a lot of people that come in with ridiculous ideas that can't be passed off in terms of, you know, scientific grounded ideas. They instead, you know, so they're not properly vetted academically. And yet they want to make some money. So you get more of those type of people coming in. So they publish some of these as well. So anyways, this guy comes in. And he has this manuscript that he pulls in. He looks very disheveled. And he's insistent that there is a conspiracy that goes all the way back 2,000, maybe 3,000 years. So he says that all these different, and he points to all these different secret societies and hermetic writings and you know, mystical texts. And he suggests that they're all interconnected and that they say that there's this powerful organization behind it all. And that he doesn't want to give them the manuscript right now, but he'll give it to them. No, wait a sec. He gives them the manuscript to read, and he says he'll be back the next day. And then he doesn't come back the next day, and they discover that he's been murdered. So anyways, underlying the whole novel is this question of, does this really, you know, this is vast, historical, complex conspiracy organizations really exist? Or is it purely created by people believing it might exist and then taking on roles that then further the belief that there may actually be a conspiracy and then basically become self-fulfilling prophecy?
Totally makes sense. I'm familiar with the Freemasons. I always joke about it. I'm like, how can you call it a secret society when they put their number in the phone book? You know, when we put the sign on the top of the building, how can we be a secret society then?
Yeah, I mean, those organizations, I think, the ones that are publicly known, at least now in the 20th century, yeah, they don't seem to have that same aura of mystery around them. But I remember as an undergraduate, I became fascinated with like these mystical societies and things like this. And so I found a section in the library I was at, and I just read my way through. And, oh, they're all so amazingly complex and rich and, you know, ludicrous in many ways. You know, just totally bonkers in sort of the way that they approach the world. And yet, you know, the amazing thing about what Eco does is that he weaves together all those actual tangible documents that you can track down now, thanks to the internet. And he creates a narrative where it's believable, where they might actually all really work together to suggest something of a larger conspiracy.
If I can bring in the most logical character of all time. Fascinating. Yeah, no, it is kind of fascinating. I think I should go back on some of those books from my undergrad days that I was too impatient as an undergrad to read.
Eco definitely has some challenges. I mean, those are the two books, Name of the Rose and Foucault's Pendulum, I think are the most readable. And I think some of his later work, I mean, is enjoyable for about the first third and then becomes too philosophical or theoretical at some point, and you just turn off. You're just hard to really follow.
Well, along those lines, let me ask you, you're a person who's well-read and everything. Are there classics that you absolutely have not been able to get through? Or just, you started reading, you're like, that's it, no, I'm out. For example, I have never read The Great Gatsby. I tried, but I got about like two chapters in, I'm like, okay, I get it. A bunch of rich people acting like assholes, got it, done.
You know, I think, you know, if anything, it just exposes sort of the areas where I've just not invested time. Because I came about things backwards, right? I mean, my training in literature is primarily self-motivated, you know, when I was growing up. And, you know, I took good classes, but I wasn't an English major. So, you know, most people in college spent their time reading all these great classics, and I just kind of bounced around through whatever I felt like reading. So I feel like there are definitely novels that I've picked up that I tried to get started on and I got bored with at some point. And I'm ashamed to say that happened with some of Dickens. And I'm amazed sometimes that I finished Moby Dick.
Oh, you're one up on me then.
Yeah. There are some that are really hard to get through some days. well, not some days, but you know, it just sometimes it seems like I'm not certain how I managed to get through it. I do enjoy reading them though. So I read Les Mis unabridged, I think, twice. And that's kind of it's like Moby Dick in the sense that there are these huge tangents that the author will go on. And they're fascinating, but it's hard to see until the very end how they all fit together into the larger narrative. You know, it's strange. I feel like the 19th century people had more patience. You would put up with this long segue to this other part of the book, even though it felt primarily historical or informational. And then at some point you'd say, oh, I guess I did need all that context for me to understand, this next character's motivation.
Well, we had less entertainment options then. We didn't have 500 channels plus the internet plus music plus whatever there may be. So you were kind of stuck in that. You had to sit through the next chapter because there was nothing else.
Yeah, totally. And I think it also, speaks to, I mean, let's face it, technology and media has had a role in shortening our attention span. So, I mean, Neil Postman writes about that in Amusing Ourselves to Death. And I think that's really sad, but true, is that, thanks to commercials, thanks to broadcast news, and thanks to the internet, we now have about like a 15 to 30 second, attention span for most things.
I blame it on MTV, honestly. Yeah. MTV introduced to television what became known as the quick cut, which is now the standard for almost every TV show. Mm. They were the first channel to really introduce that in the mid-80s. It wasn't right away, but they slowly worked on it, and then they got to this. Now, whenever you see fast-paced editing and such, it's all direct result of MTV style. So
I hadn't made that connection before, but yeah, that is, it's true. And it does definitely, reinforce the way that news has become a type of entertainment instead of, information.
TV news at this point, is it even worth it? Because they're still running on a model that is 20 years out of date, where they're saying it, say, 4 p.m. tonight on the show, we'll tell you the 6 things that you need to know about buying a new refrigerator tonight at 11.
Yeah, I know very few people that still watch news. I get everything off of the internet these days. I go to my Google News aggregator and I just read, 2 or 3 stories about the same idea. I try to get multiple perspectives, but I'm not really willing to sit down and wait for a broadcast to tell me how I'm supposed to read or understand a situation. I want to read all around it as much as I can.
Especially because those things that they tell us to wait for are usually more human interest things that if I really want to know, I can go to a website for local media and ta-da, there it is right now. I don't have to worry about it.
No, exactly.
They're running on this outdated model that needs to be destroyed. It's kind of like daylight savings time. I think that's an outdated model as well.
Which we're facing down this weekend, yes.
Okay.
Give me back my hour. I don't want to lose my hour this weekend.
I don't mind taking away an hour because it gives us another hour of daylight and pushes sunset back. Fine, but it's an agricultural model. It's no longer needed. Let's just dump it.
Funny you should mention that. I spent a good chunk of my childhood in Saskatchewan, Canada, which very conveniently is located in Central Standard Time. So there is no daylight savings time there.
So were you born in Canada?
I was born in Vancouver, British Columbia, and then I kind of grew up all over the world up until I was 5, and then we came back to Canada, and I spent the rest of my childhood in Canada.
Is that because of parents both being librarians and such?
Yes, because that's a jet-setter lifestyle. No, my father started off, he did his undergraduate work in linguistics and teaching English second language, so his first job was actually in Saudi Arabia. And so we lived in Saudi Arabia briefly, and then we went to Taiwan also briefly. And then he just kind of said, it's just too hard to raise a family if your contracts are maybe 1 to 2 years in length, and then you have to move on. He was kind of international ESL teacher, was basically that generation's adjunct. You had nothing permanent, and you just had to keep moving contract to contract. So he went back to school, and he got a master's degree in library science. And then we ended up in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, which is almost halfway up a very long province in Canada. Then we ended up eventually down in the capital city, which is closer to the border.
you know, I'm not going to stereotype because I have Canadian blood in me as well, just not directly. It's, you know, long branch of the family.
Yeah, not directly. It's from the time I killed this guy and it splashed on.
Exactly, you know, and I just absorbed it.
Like a mutant.
Exactly, and suddenly I became partial Canadian. No, it's a small branch of the family is from Nova Scotia and Toronto, my father's uncle. I'm curious about growing up in Canada because I have a deep affection for it. I grew up 3-4 hours from the border. So I was close enough that I could make the Canadian beer run, you know, where you would go across the border, get like $300 worth of Canadian beer in your trunk, and at customs and the border, what do you have in the car, sir? About $300 worth of beer, bringing it back. Have a good day, sir. Okay, thanks. So what was amazing about growing up in Canada? Was there anything amazing? Because you're talking about the Plains area, you're mid-Canada there.
Yeah.
And a town that sounds very small.
Well, so the first city I lived in, because we could call it a city because there's not much competition, North Balfour was about 40, 45,000 people. But it was all agricultural outside of that. I don't know. It was like there, and then the second city, I'll say the name, but everyone always jokes about this because in Canada, we don't blink an eye, but everyone else looks at me funny when I say that I spent most of my childhood in Regina, Saskatchewan. Not Regina, Regina. Exactly. Snicker.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get the 12-year-old out of us, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, and that was closer to the border, like an hour and a half, 2 hours away from the border. But, you know, what was it like? It was winter for about 3/4 a year when I was growing up. Most of the province, the southern half of the province, is very, very flat. In fact, it's possibly some of the flattest land in the world. And so it was amazing because there's, you know, low population, large amounts of land, agricultural, so that means that there's a lot of topsoil, also a lot of dust. So the sunsets and sunrises were gorgeous, amazing, because of all the particulate matter in the air. And then at night, the skies were gigantic. It was, you could see, you know, thousands, maybe millions of stars. It was just amazing to look up. And then you're far enough north, you know, of the U.S. border that you can see the northern lights. And so I grew up, you know, growing up in a place like that meant that I grew up, you know, I grew up with a really deep appreciation for how small ultimately each of us is in the face of like the gigantic, you know, expanse of you know, the heavens and the earth. You're just a small person there. And yet how intimate the connection is, that stripped away of pavement and concrete and buildings and glass and steel, you could be just this human being with your feet in the dirt and the wind blowing and, you know, sneezing because of the wheat and the grass seed in the air and pollen. But, you know, it's just a very elemental and basic, you know, existence once you get outside of the city. And it was very easy to get outside the city. And I think even now, you know, I live now in Los Angeles and, you know, it's the complete opposite, right? And I used to live in various parts of Taiwan. And there again, it's like there's this huge separation between when you're in the city, it is all city. You'll not see a speck of dirt anywhere because it's all, I mean, you'll see grime, but you won't see earth. And then if you go out into the countryside, you know, you can get into jungle. But in Saskatchewan, it was just like there were no barriers to doing that. You just drove, you know, 15, 20 minutes outside of town and you were in farmland and there's just you and the elements.
In some ways, it sounds like paradise to me.
I think it's a great place to grow up as a writer and an artist. I think, you know, you get a new appreciation. A lot of artists will say there's a different quality of light in Saskatchewan just because there's just very little air pollution and the way it's positioned, I think, as well, you know, in terms of, you know, latitude. It's an interesting place to grow up. The other thing is that there's so much open road, you know, you feel like you can go anywhere. It's funny too. It's so, you know, we have a couple jokes that we always tell in Saskatchewan. And so I'm going to ruin it for anyone that comes to one of my readings in the future because they'll hear this joke. But I always tell them that, you know, one of the famous things about Saskatchewan is that it's really, really flat. In fact, it's so flat you can watch your dog run away for 3 days. And that, you know, the joke is so popular that it ended up in the theme song for one of the Canadian sitcoms. But the other, you know, I didn't know that until years later. But the other thing that's really, this is true, is that when you're driving to a destination in Saskatchewan, you can usually see your destination 45 minutes before you get there.
And then you have to calculate in your brain, okay, is that a mirage? How long is it actually going to take me to get yeah. there? Because when you've been traveling for a couple of hours, you suddenly see it, you're like, yes, I want to be right there now. Be done with
this. It's a lot like the Monty Python Quest for the Holy Grail scene where the guy's running out of the forest towards the camera. And, you know, it seems like he's far away. It seems like he's far away. And then immediately he's there.
Yeah, it's like they keep cutting back to the knights, and they cut back and he's still running. And it's just the same piece of footage. They cut back, same piece of footage. Next one, boom, he's right on top of them.
So I felt that way a lot of times driving towards destinations. It's like, It's there. I don't feel like I've made any progress. I'm driving at full speed, and I'm not making any progress. And then finally, it's like, oh, we're here.
Boom. How did you come then to live in Los Angeles? Because, you know, you're a world traveler and everything. How did you wind up in L.A.?
Well, I came to L.A. in 2000. I was living in Calgary, Alberta, mostly unemployed, in my sister's basement while I was looking for work. I had a rather disastrous year after I graduated from university with my computer science degree, and the job I was supposed to take fell through. And so I ended up going back to Canada, and I discovered my skill set didn't match the city. And so I was having a terrible time finding work locally. And then I started to expand my search, and I was thinking, I like to teach, I like to code. Maybe I should look for something in educational software. And so I was looking for those type of jobs, and I found a company in LA, actually it was in Glendale, that did educational software. And so I cold called them, or actually cold contacted them. I wrote them an email and I explained to them my background, my situation, and what I had as skills to offer, despite the fact they had nothing listed as an opening. And they got back to me, and I ended up, after going back and forth with interviews, they flew me down and offered me the job. So I came to Glendale 2000 to work as a computer games programmer for an educational software company. And that's how I started. So I spent about 5 years doing that. And then one day I just kind of, towards the end of that, I realized I was not really happy. You know, I was going to poetry readings in the evenings whenever I could and writing on the side, but it was no longer enough. And I wanted to do something more than sit in a cubicle and work all day long. You know, I wanted to at least do an MFA and hopefully find a way into, a full-time teaching position.
See where it takes you kind of thing. Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah. I very similar, actually. 2005, 2006, I had nothing going. With an MA in English, couldn't get work where I was. And then I tell the story often, this is how it happened. I am watching Scarface for the first time on TV, and I'm eating an ice cream sandwich. And I just said, I've never been a doctor before. I'm going to do that. So next thing I know, within 2 years, I'm then getting my PhD.
There was momentum for you know, the MFA was something I wanted to do. And it actually led to an interesting conversation, because there's that moment where you have to call your parents and tell them, you know, and say, hey, guess what, Mom and Dad? I've decided that I'm going to leave my very well-paying job as a computer games programmer to go and pursue an MFA in creative writing.
It must have been a fun conversation that day.
You know, I was not certain what was going to happen in that conversation. So I picked up the phone. I was talking to I got a hold of my dad, and I talked to my dad. And my dad, such an amazing guy. He said the things, what did he say? He said, it's about time. Welcome back to the fold. It was like, he always knew I was going to come back eventually to doing something in art and literature. And it's like, I feel extremely blessed that was, and my mother was very supportive too. And I was like, you know, I thought she might be a little bit tougher to please, but no, they're both very supportive. My father had been the first person in his family to get a master's. And, you know, eventually when I decided that I needed to come back and do a PhD, you know, my father, you know, that was one of the things he told me. He says, look, do this and you'll be the first person in our line that gets a doctorate. And so that's one of the things that I kind of look at as sort of a responsibility, is to finish this thing.
It's a motivator. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm the first one in my family to have a PhD as well. And toward the end, it became a dogfight between me and my cousin, who was just about to finish her MD. Mm. And so it was a question of who was going to get the diploma first and be the first doctor in the whole family. I think, I want to say, I'd have to double check, but I think I beat her by a week. or something in terms of the actual commencement date. That's what it came down to. And I can totally understand the dissatisfaction of having that job. I've worked those shit jobs too myself, where the soul just gets sucked away. And the desire comes back of, you know, why not? Because I started out in film. And just, I got into basically a fight with the film department. They wanted me to be a filmmaker I didn't want to be. And I just said, that's it, I'm out of here. And went into English because I'm like, I always like stories. Why not? Never done this. And just never looked back.
Yeah, I had that moment where I just woke up one day and I said, I'm very good at what I do, but I don't love it anymore. I simply don't love it. And I had a friend of mine, you know, an older guy that I knew who was, he and his wife lived in the area, actually stayed with them when I first moved out to LA. And I would talk to him because he was a programmer as well. And I talked to him about like how he, you know, he'd spent like something like 40 years in that job. I asked him how, you know, what his feeling was about the career, and he said, to be perfectly honest, I hate my job. He's like, he has to keep doing it because he has a family to support, and they got other bills to pay, and he has to do it. I mean, part of me realizes we're all going to have parts of our job that are just not pleasant, you know? Like, I don't enjoy grading papers. That's unavoidable.
Find me a teacher who does.
If they do, they take particular sadistic delight in grading papers, and I'm not one of those people.
Or they're senile.
Or they've developed a system where, you know, it is completely arbitrary, and they don't have to justify anything at all.
They become Sherlock Holmes and automaton, basically.
Well, you could. I've seen some people, you know, I met a couple people that really are machine-like in their grading, and somehow they can remove themselves to such a degree that it's just, you know, boom, 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 boom. They go through these things, and I have no idea how they crank out those responses so quickly. But
yeah, the only time I can do something, anything like that, is when I know I'm on a deadline.
Yeah.
Like the papers have to come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
Then I can do it, but
I can do it. You know, I guess I can do it too at some level, but it's not enjoyable to me. To me, you know, the things that I enjoy most about, you know, a career in teaching, I would say, have to do with the mentoring side, working one-on-one with people, you know, teaching a new concept and having sort of the light bulb go off in someone's head, or sort of a discussion where it veers off in a completely unexpected direction that ends up exposing a whole different understanding of the material than any of us in the room had anticipated. And to me, those are like magical moments when something happens that I did not expect and I learned something and hopefully everyone else in the room learned something. Those are the type of experiences, I think, that make teaching such a wonderful, you know, sort of a career. But I guess the challenge of it is how do you preserve that and balance it with sort of the more bureaucratic demands of, you know, working within an institution that has expected reporting, requires some way of gradation between your students' performances and all these other things. And I think, you know, there's a part of me that wishes that you could have sort of the anti, you know, the opposite of, you know, a formal university experience where grades were completely thrown out and you simply had discussions. And, you know, I had this discussion actually recently with one of my friends and said, wouldn't it be nice if we could just simply say, this person's progressing, this person's, you know, standing still, not really progressing that much, and this person's kind of falling behind. And that was the effective grade that you gave on each assignment or each, you know, person's performance in the class. And that's all you had to report. I think that would be great. I mean, that's the type of feedback that you want as a student, right? Is to be able to say, yeah, I'm moving forward, or no, I'm kind of stuck. I have no idea where I'm supposed to go from here.
Or they've just given up.
Or they've just given up. You know, this person's just, I've got a couple people like that in the class I'm TAing right now where I'm kind of concerned. I pretty much feel like they've just given up. You know, based on their test scores, it doesn't seem like they're really mentally present in the class. So.
And you're going to have that in every class. There will always be students. I was told when I first started teaching and TAing, I was told you can't save everybody.
No.
You want to as a teacher. I know that for a fact. It's from my own experience. You want to save everyone. You want to give everyone a chance and work with them. But, you know, a friend of mine told me once that he had a student basically just walk in the room one time and was not doing anything in the class. And so in a one-on-one conference for a paper, and he said, you know, you're having struggling with this course or anything. And they said, I'm only here because mommy and daddy are paying me to go here. Okay, then. Well, thank you for being honest about it. Now I can turn my attention to somebody else.
Yeah, I caught a composition class one time, and there was a student in there that I caught plagiarizing in the sense that he borrowed his entire idea from the Wikipedia article about the, you know, about the concept. And so I kind of like pulled him aside and talked to him about what he was doing and why it wasn't really appropriate. And I kind of had a suspicion there was a deeper problem going on here. So I said, you know, because the class was supposed to be about, you know, composition and critical thinking. And so I said, well, what kind of critical thinking have you done in the past? Have you done any sort of critical writing? He says, I really don't make decisions. My parents always tell me what I'm supposed to do. And so I said, what are you studying then? What's your major? What do you want to do in the future? I don't know what I'm going to do in the future, but my parents want me to study public policy. I was like, so I'm like thinking, here's a future politician who has no idea how to think critically and has never thought critically in his life. And
this explains so much.
It's like, I was terrified. It's like, really?
It really explains a lot about the legislatures and politicians who say, I know how to run education. Really?
I dropped out, but I know how to run education.
I only have a bachelor's degree, but I can tell you that students need to work harder.
Oh, you know, the language they use about that reminds me so much of when I used to work as a programmer, and they'd say, we're going to have to lay off some people this year. That means that we're all going to have to work harder and smarter. And it's like, and what they don't say is, and longer, but we're going to pay you exactly the same.
Yeah, sorry. No additional benefits here.
There are standard rules, you know, philosophical rules, not just philosophical, design rules that hold up, right? And then basically it's like it is impossible to have something, you know, fast, efficient, and cheap. Choose two. That's all you get. So you can't expect to win on every single point. You can only guarantee, and if you're lucky, you can guarantee two out of the three. And so I feel like the discussions we have around education, the discussions we have around a lot of different things, you know, there is an unrealistic expectation that we somehow are able to accommodate all three things or accomplish all three things. And the reality is, no, you can't. It's going to cost you a lot more, or we're going to take a lot longer, or it's not going to be the efficient way to do it, but we'll be able to get, you know, your other two goals done.
Yeah, I grew up on, you know, first big generation of console video gaming, the Atari system and everything. And now when I look at it and having learned about the era and learning about as time goes on and everything, when I see a bad game come out, I don't immediately go, oh, the programmers didn't know what they were doing or the producers didn't know what they were doing. I now look at it and go, there's more to this. The reason E.T. sucked as a video game so badly, it's because of the programmers, not the programmers themselves. It was their mid-level management going, we need to have this out by Christmas. You got 6 weeks to put together a game.
Deadlines are the killer. And if you are low person on the totem pole, right? If you're so educational software, I worked for Knowledge Venture, and our parent company was Vivendi Universal Games. Vivendi owned Blizzard and Sierra. And so we were the small, we were the redheaded stepchild of the whole thing, right? Educational games, kids games don't make a ton of money. Especially not even kids games. Educational products don't make a ton of money in comparison with, oh, WoW and StarCraft and, yeah, you know, other games that kind of have a, you know, even the King's Quest series, you know, is going to make more money than Jumpstart, you know. One exception probably being my last product I worked on, which was Barbie Princess and Popper, which at that point I said, are we even doing anything educational with this? You just want me to write for someone else.
Edutainment. Where are we falling here? How much edu and how much tainment are we doing?
It was mostly tainment at that point. Yeah, it was like they stopped pretending after a while and they just said, oh, you're kids entertainment now.
Yeah. I forget the no part of your title now. Forget that. You're just Quest. No longer Knowledge Quest, you are just Quest.
Right. So, I mean, it was kind of, you know, frustrating. But I witnessed it on the inside, which is basically you'd have deadlines because of production. You get like a window in the CD or the DVD production factory and say, everyone else has to, the big games are coming out on these schedules. We have an exact 2-week or 1-week period of time where this product has to release. So it has to release. And yep. So it just, that's how it worked. And then the other problems you'd run into would be, you know, the philosophy, the management philosophy that if we were behind, you threw more people at the project and it would somehow get better. But that doesn't work. It's like then you have to train all these new people in how something works on the inside, and you waste time. You know, it's better if you simply move back the date by another 2 weeks and then release later.
But, you know, then you miss out on the big Christmas rush.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you're stuck there. And there are the some games out there that understand that a little bit. Like, I think of KOTOR 2. I was just reading another article about Knights of the Old Republic 2, the Star Wars game. They cut a third of the game because of time constraint. They had to have it out in time for the release, but they were nice enough to include a lot of the files on there on discs. And since then, there has been this group reprogramming the game to make the uncut version of what it was originally supposed to be, because they left all the sound files in there and the sketches of, like, okay, this was going to be the level that was supposed to be built here. So kudos to them for that. But yeah, having become more aware, not, I've never been on the inside, but I know enough about the inside to go, now I understand why games go bad.
And sometimes it's like the game, you know, the programmers are going, you know, the gameplay on this is just not going to be fun. They can see it. We work with enough games that we don't need to have all the art assets in before we can tell you that the gameplay, even looking at the spec on it, we can say the gameplay is not going to be fun for this. And but the problem is the producers, who are frequently not programmers and haven't taken game design or haven't taken, or there was a class I took on the theoretical foundations of computer science, which basically was a discussion of what was programmable and what was completely impossible. And so you could understand it from a very, very high level, abstract, you know, logic, mathematical approach. And so you look at a design and say, that's actually not even possible. It's like, we can't do that. That's, it doesn't matter how much money you throw at us, we cannot make that work. So we would see it, but we'd have a lot of difficulty pushing back on the producers or the executive producers that might have a completely different, you know, they have a vision for how they think it's going to work, but until you show them how it plays, they're not going to understand that it doesn't, either it doesn't work or it isn't fun.
Yeah, it's the big fight between client and producer.
Yep.
Of it. The client wants X, Y, and Z, and you say, hey, no, you're only going to get X and Y, because if you throw Z on top of it, it's going to mess up X and Y, and you end up with nothing.
Or the other problem of basic feature creep, you know, it's like people that want more bells and whistles to the game, when the reality is that none of those things add to the fun of the game. You know, sometimes a pure and simple but innovative gameplay mechanic is much more, you know, much more attractive than a complex, overwrought, and overdone gameplay that you've seen thousands of times already. Like, how many times do we need to play Space Invaders? You know, it's, you know, and we'll even say that. We'll say that that's really just a Space Invaders game. And so sometimes we'll kind of leverage that and say, is there a new spin we can put on this? But a lot of times, you know, if it's been done to death, you know, you just kind of say, you know, is there a different game that we could do?
And I think that's where you're seeing a lot of the best development right now is in smaller independent ones coming out with, and even big names like, I think of Valve coming out with Portal and shocking everyone and going, this is such a simple concept for a design. And then you came out with this beautiful game with it. Really surprised a lot of people.
Yeah. The truth is that really good games rely on elegant and often simple but elegant, you know, mechanics. Something that you think, oh, you know, that's very clever and simple at the same time. And it's intuitive to play. You want something that's intuitive. Portal is very intuitive, you know. And the challenge and the complexity come from layouts, from other things that really boil down to level design and less to do with, you know, making the gameplay more complicated. It's really not a problem of changing the interface mechanic. It's more about making the level, the spatial element more difficult.
Yeah, use the level against the player. So one thing I know about you is that you are multifaceted, just from talking to you even. Okay, we've got the gaming, we got the literature, but you're also a visual artist?
Yeah, I used to paint through high school, and I think these days I don't have space or time really or even money to really invest in new materials. So I don't paint as much anymore. Occasionally we'll do a little bit of watercolor, but for the most part I've kind of turned to photography. And even these days with the dissertation, I don't spend a lot of time taking photos. But yeah, I used to be an artist, more so than now. I guess I still do design work when I build websites for other people.
It's never going to leave you. It's just that right now you got another focus, primary focus, but it's one of those things that won't go away in you.
Yeah, it won't go away. I suck at it now. There was a couple years ago, I tried my hand at doing something, you know, a little bit more elaborate, and I realized how much I'd forgotten. It was like, wow, I was never good at doing the human figure, but boy, it's pretty bad now. And then I thought I had much better control over watercolor when I was younger than I do now. But on the other hand, you know, there are other things that I think what doesn't leave you is a sense of composition, you know, to which I think is always going to be valuable, is like understanding how to frame. You know, if you studied film, you're going to know this too, which is how do you frame a scene? How do you compose the elements in the scene? You know, these things are important, and, you know, and they transfer over to writing. You know, they transfer, whether you're creating a scene in a poem or in a short story or in a longer piece of, you know, creative nonfiction, you know, how you frame or compose a scene, how you arrange the elements within, you know, how you set one image against another image, those type of things are going to be, you know, always going to be valuable and part of, you know, how you write. So I think that the art background definitely has helped me both in terms of, you know, a visual imagination and at the same time a sense of composition and framing.
Yeah, because even though I haven't done film in 15, 20 years or so, when I sit down and watch a movie or a TV show, as soon as something's happening, I can go, that is a gorgeous shot. Mm-hmm. So immediately I can recognize the brilliance of it. I was watching House of Cards season 3, and there was one shot mid-season where just the lighting was absolutely perfect, silhouetting mm-hmm. the person. I'm like, that is good. Thank you for that. See, you don't do much photography anymore, but who knows? You might, in the next couple of years, you might get back to it.
By far, that's the easiest thing for me to get back to, because really what I love about photography is that it just puts forward primarily, you know, it privileges sort of composition and framing, which are things that, those are the things I haven't really lost. And so I can play with light and I can play with composition and I can play with the frame.
Does it bother you that with camera phones and the accessibility of it and Instagram and Snapchat and all these other websites and programs and utilities now, does it bother you that almost everyone now calls themselves a photographer, or is there still a specialization to it?
I don't know if it really bothers me. I mean, it's the same problem with like the proliferation of blogging and online websites. Everyone became a publisher and an author, right? And does it, you know, yes, it has an impact. It can water down the sense of like, well, who is really a photographer and who's really a writer? But at the same time, it's a democratization. It turns it around and everyone has an opportunity to try it out and see how they do. I think what is going to be true is that you will be able to tell, you know, just like, you know, since I run a literary journal as well, you know, I get a flood of poetry submissions and I can tell very quickly who has been doing the time to, or has the talent, and the poems come in and they're polished, not just polished, but they're fresh. They're like a completely new way of thinking about something. It's something I haven't seen before. And the way it is framed and composed, you know, as a poem, the way that the pieces fit together, you know, really are striking and stand out. There's a sense of both economy and elegance in terms of how it's put together. You know, I feel that way when I look at photography. I say, I can see someone has a good eye. They understand sort of how to pull out this emotional content, you know, to evoke a sense or a tone out of a scene through the careful composition of these things. And who's just kind of randomly shooting around. And the randomly shooting around stuff ends up feeling flat. It feels, you know, there's nothing that really resonates with me. It just feels like I could have 100, and you probably do have 100 shots that look very similar, slightly different, versus one that is very thought out, you know, that someone, whether it was done in an instant or done with a lot of time, but someone has recognized that moment as something that can be captured and set aside as, you know, they recognize it as art, you know, or something beautiful, something remarkable.
You might agree with this. There's a lot of good to these, so many sites out there that publish basically any poetry or let people try their hand at it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there is still a gatekeeper in place. If it's not a person, it's the art itself that acts as a gatekeeper and says, everybody can do this, but there comes a certain craft. There comes a point where just wanting to do it isn't enough.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, that's the challenge, right? Within a couple seconds, within a few lines, you have a sense of whether or not you're in the presence of someone who knows what they're doing or someone that's just kind of throwing stuff at the page and hoping that's going to work out. And it doesn't take very long to recognize that. The greatest challenge of being an editor is not identifying poems that are not good. It's identifying the difference between a truly great poem and one which is good, competent, but ultimately not, you know, not sufficiently memorable or not sufficiently innovative. It's almost there, but it doesn't really rise above what I've seen already. And, you know, what I want is a poem that is unmistakable. When I read this, this stands out from other things I've seen. I haven't seen anything like it, and it haunts me. I love the idea that the images or the lines that you encounter are going to haunt you for days afterwards, and you'll keep going back and thinking about how it worked in that particular way. And you may not always understand it. In fact, you hope that you don't completely understand it, because then the mystery is something that you can savor for a longer period of time.
You're going to get more mileage out of it by wandering around for 3 days going, I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah. I love poems that put me a little bit at unease. You know, I'm not completely settled. You know, if I read a poem and it takes me to the place that I already knew the poem was going to take me, then there's no journey. And then I haven't gone anywhere. And there's no surprise. And I want to arrive someplace completely unexpected and say, whoa, how did we get here? I've trusted the voice in this poem to this point, and yet I never would have suspected we would have ended up here. And it's so strange, and yet it's kind of this magical beauty that I want to hold on to, or the mystery of it that I want to figure out.
Yeah, that swerve is... Oh, I'm starting to really think about this more and more because I just recently watched the original RoboCop again. It's one of my favorite 80s films. I staunchly refuse to see the remake. I don't believe it exists. It never did. But I was recently watching it, and I went back to, as I do with a lot of old movies, I go to Roger Ebert's review and see what he originally wrote on it, just out of curiosity. And he says, what's beautiful about this film is that it starts off as feeling like an action film, gruesome, etc. And then they get to the Ed 209 boardroom scene, and suddenly it becomes dark comedy, and you don't see it coming, and suddenly you find yourself giggling and going, I thought I was in for a generic action horror film, and now I'm laughing. And I've discovered, thinking about that more and more, about my favorite films, that's something I really love in narrative. Take me and don't go to a cliche place. Take me in a direction I don't expect or see coming.
Yeah, one of my favorite movies, because I remember watching it and being completely blown away because there was nothing in it that I thought would happen the way it did, was Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville, 1965.
Okay.
So it's French New Wave cinema. It is this bizarre combination. So basically, Godard takes a cliche gumshoe detective who's appeared in a number of other movies. And he lands the role, the opportunity to make a mystery movie with him. Except for instead of making a typical mystery movie, he presents this guy as traveling to Alphaville, which is in another galaxy, which looks oddly like Paris in 1965, but mostly focused on the modernist buildings and the futurist buildings. And it's a city that is run, and this fits all back with our earlier discussion, it's run by a master computer who has outlawed everything irrational and emotional. And Lemmy Caution, who's this detective, is there posing as a reporter trying to track down a scientist who is responsible for a murder elsewhere. And so what happens is you have this movie that is part mystery, part film noir, part romance, part technological dystopia, part sci-fi, definitely very avant-garde. There's an execution, which is, you know, so there's an execution at a swimming pool by firing squad with synchronized swimming happening at the back in the background. There's like all these bizarre combinations of things There are references to vampires, references to all sorts of different things. And you're like going, how does this all work? And yet somehow, bizarrely, it works. And some of the best moments in the film are these interrogation scenes where Alpha 60, the computer, is pulls in Caution to have an interrogation about what he's really doing there, trying to figure out who he really is. And the conversation basically, is this interrogation, Alpha 60 will ask these really hard-hitting questions, and Caution responds with lines of poetry, most of which are actually borrowed from French symbolist poets from the period, or just a little bit earlier. And so it's this weird dialogue between poetry and sort of this clinical, analytical approach. And then later on, there's a confrontation at the end where Caution arranges to escape with, sort of the love interest of the movie, who's actually a programmer, bizarrely. And they leave because Caution is able to pose a question that the computer, Alpha 60, can't resolve. And so what Caution accuses the computer of is that the computer will never, the computer has this quest to try to understand Caution. And Caution says, you'll never understand me because I am human and I am mortal and you are a computer. Effectively, he says, you're a computer and you'll never understand death and mortality. And the computer ends up going insane. But the computer's lines that he quotes as the computer is going insane are all lines that ultimately come back from Borges. So it's a really bizarre film. And it is like you're watching it, you don't know when to laugh, you don't know, how serious it's supposed to be. And there are some really gorgeous shots that kind of permeate the whole thing. And these moments, which really are, it is kind of this really bizarre poetry of a film and a poem of a film. I think it completely defamiliarizes and destabilizes what you think of as being a traditional narrative. And I love it. I love it because it kind of makes technology and art, it has references to Orwell. It has references to all sorts of other stuff. But it's really quite the remarkable little film.
Totally get where you're coming from. I prefer art that's going to, challenge me in the good way. Not challenge me as in, I'm a puzzle, I'm going to make you think to the degree that you're in pain.
Yeah.
But I want you to give me something more than just, there's something about Mary level. Give me something that shows there's an intelligence behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That you're going to make me think, but not to the point where I'm like, I'm thinking of Stan Brakhage now, because you mentioned Godard, so I'm thinking my film school background, I'm like, I'm sorry, but Brakhage and I just didn't get along in the end watching his films. Because I'm like, no, I don't need to see you playing with your wife's placenta on screen. it's not going to help me here with this film, but Godard, okay, I can go with this. Or The Seventh Seal, I can go with this. Okay, you're going to play chess against death. Interesting. We'll see how this turns out.
Speaking of Bergman, I don't know if you've seen, someone put up recently on YouTube, a film short of The Flash as directed by Ingmar Bergman.
I might have to look that up.
It's brilliant. It is really, really brilliant.
In exchange here, I will tell you to look up, if you have not seen it, Where's Waldo and Curious George as read by Werner Herzog.
Oh, okay. I will have to.
It's not actually Herzog. It's an impersonator, but it's as if he had written those stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful, the introspection on Curious George's ultimate failings to become man. So, great little amusement. Neil, we're almost out of time, man.
Yeah, I know. It went by quick.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
And I feel like we didn't even begin to touch on some interesting stuff here. A lot of philosophical discussion today about art, though.
We barely scraped the surface. I mean, there are all sorts of other things. I guess this is the curse of being a librarian's son, is that you end up wanting to read and study everything. And so I find, like, I love conversations with complete strangers because I invariably learn something new about the world and about what they do and how they fit into it. And there's always something that I'm not expecting. And then, it feeds back into your what you draw on for writing, is the sense that, there are people that do, I grew up, at one point we grew up next door to a woman who was the first female welder in the city. I was like, it's so bizarre. It's like, But someone had to be first, and she was the first one. You know, and you never know. Everyone has these interesting life stories, and, yeah. And I find like that's for me. I'm like, I try to pick up a little bit about everything that I come across.
Well, maybe that's why we do it as writers, is that we are just obsessed with personal narratives and learning about people. You know, what's your deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're always doing is as writers. I mean, it is an introspective art, but in order to understand ourselves, we have to understand others. We have to encounter others to think about ourselves and say, well, how are we the same and how are we different? You know, that's kind of the thread that runs through sort of, you know, even my dissertation and the discussion about Sherlock Holmes and the discussion about thinking machines is really our anxiety about that, about like, what if we encounter something that is also thinking, but not us?
Well, if people want to think about you, where should they find you online? Try to go for a segue there, you know.
I'd say find me on my website, Neil, N-E-I-L, hyphen, Aiken, AITKEN.com. So Neil-Aiken.com. And Boxcar Poetry Review is a literary journal that I run. And Facebook, and if you just Google me, I'll show up all over the place. Much to the chagrin, I think, of the other Neil Aikens that exist in the world. I've been around online longer, so I kind of show up everywhere.
So we'll have to check you out. You got any work you want to plug coming down the pike or anything?
Right now, I think the big thing is, I'll be at AWP with Boxcar Poetry Review in the book fair. And then the other thing is I have a chapbook forthcoming from Hyacinth Girl Press called Leviathan, which is a collection of poems about Charles Babbage and early computers.
Kick ass. So, well, we'll have to look for you then at AWP for our listeners who go. And for those who don't, yeah, you can find Neil in the digital world. So, there we go. All right, Neil, take care of yourself. It was great having you. Thank you so much for being here,
fantastic.
Man.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, we'll do.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.